This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Alexander Skarsgård, stars as a Viking in the new movie The Northmen. Set toward the end of the 10th century, the story is based on Norse mythology. In the HBO series True Blood, Skarsgård played Eric Northman, who became a vampire 1,000 years ago when he was a Viking. More recently, Skarsgård played an abusive husband in Big Little Lies, for which he won an Emmy, Golden Globe, a Critics' Choice Television Award, and an award from SAG, the Screen Actors Guild. In the latest season of HBO's Succession, he played a tech billionaire. Alexander Skarsgård grew up in Stockholm, Sweden, where he's joining us from now. He's the son of the prominent actor Stellan Skarsgård, who's appeared in movies, stage, and TV since the 60s, and he's the brother of Bill Skarsgård, who's famous for his role as Pennywise, the dancing clown in the supernatural horror film It, based on a Stephen King story. Alexander Skarsgård had his first film role at the age of 7, and a film he made at the age of 13 made him famous in Sweden. After that, he took a 7-year break from acting. When Skarsgård was growing up in Sweden, he watched Viking movies and learned about some of the mythology from his grandfather. The new movie The Northmen begins with his character as a young prince who witnesses his father, the king, be murdered by the prince's uncle, who then makes off with the prince's mother, the queen. The boy dedicates his life to avenging his father, saving his mother, and killing his uncle. The film skips ahead to 20 years later, when Skarsgård's character Amleth is part of a group of marauding Vikings who plunder and burn villages and slaughter the people living there. As one character describes him, he's a beast cloaked in man flesh. He acts like a beast, and he howls like a beast, as you'll hear in this scene in which the Vikings, on a night before a raid, are doing a warrior dance, chanting around a bonfire at night. The chant turns into roars, and at the end, you hear Skarsgård howl. Alexander Skarsgård, welcome to Fresh Air. Did you have a voice left after that?
Thank you very much, Terry. I'm honored to be speaking to you.
That is quite a howl.
I basically didn't have a voice for 7 months because we did. That was one moment, but there's probably 15, 20 other scenes in the movie in which my character kind of has a crank it up to 11. I guess I didn't use my diaphragm correctly because my voice was completely gone.
Where did you find that rage in yourself?
That's a good question. In the clip we just heard, my character, it's a transformation. My character is a Viking berserker, and his spirit animal is a hybrid of a wolf and a bear. And there, it's this ritual that they go through before a raid of a village. And it was about shedding your humanity in a way, letting go of your humanity and turning into a beast. So tapping into a more atavistic, more animalistic state. It was quite cathartic. I'm quite a mellow guy. I don't scream a lot. I don't like arguments. I don't like fights. I'm very Swedish, I guess. So in a way, it was quite thrilling and exciting to shoot those scenes because I definitely got to tap into something I don't tap into very often, to kind of find that inner animal and let it out.
So you grew up in Sweden. Your grandfather taught you a lot about the Vikings and Norse mythology. Did your grandfather feel any personal connections to those ancient stories?
Yeah, he did. He actually, to the point where my grandfather and his two brothers actually changed their last name from Nilsson to Skarsgård in the 40s. And the etymology behind the word is Skarsgård, which means the farm of Skåre. And that is a Viking farm on Öland, which is an island in the Baltic Sea on which his father, my great-grandfather, built a wooden cabin over 100 years ago. And it's a cabin that we still have in the family, and we go there every summer. he claimed that we were direct ancestors of Skaldr, but again, who knows? It was 1,000 years ago. We definitely know that we have ancestors many, many generations back from Erland, that island.
I thought I read that there were pacifists in your family, which doesn't match with the image of Vikings in your new movie.
No, it's true. My dad was a hippie and very much a pacifist. And so I grew up in that environment. It was a very bohemian lifestyle with my dad, obviously, my mom, but also the whole extended family. I was a ragtag group of poets and artists and very, very left-leaning progressive people.
There are supernatural elements in the movie, and I'm sure there are supernatural elements in the stories and mythology of the Vikings. What are some of the stories or some of the images or supernatural elements that your grandfather told you about that really stuck with you?
He told me about in the cabin, there's no bathroom, so you would have to go outside to pee. And early in the morning, Grandpa and I went out into the grass to pee. We would feel the dew under our feet, the wet grass. And Grandpa explained that the dew is actually not condensation. It's not water. It's sweat from the flanks of the Valkyrie's horses, because at night, the Vikings believed that the slain warriors would get picked up during the night by the Valkyries, these female warriors that would ride down from Valhall or Valhalla and pick up the warriors and then ride back, bring them to Odin in Valhalla. And they were very busy during the night because a lot of the warriors had been slain. So the horses got sweaty, and the dew that we stood on and felt under our feet was actually the sweat of the Valkyrie's steeds. He didn't believe in it, obviously, and he didn't. But he told me those stories, and he didn't try to convince me that it was actually true. But he had an amazing imagination, and he loved again history and those old stories from the Norse mythology. And that's one that really stuck with me.
Yeah, I guess it made wet grass a lot more exciting.
It did. It sure did. It sure did. And that was also something that we, many, many years later, tried to capture and tried to, in the Northmen, that line between the natural world and the supernatural world, the spiritual world. We wanted to blur that line because, again, the components, the elements of the film that might seem supernatural to an audience in 2022 would not have been strange at all to a Viking 1,000 years ago. And what we tried to accomplish was for the audience to see the world through Amleth's eyes. So when he gets picked up by a Valkyrie to be taken to Valhalla, or when he has to fight a 7-foot skeleton giant, it's not surprising to him. Because again, these are stories, part of the folklore, stories he's been told since he was a toddler. So we again try to kind of just blur the line between the natural and the supernatural.
So one of the things you had to learn for the new movie is how to fight with weapons that are supposed to look like very ancient weapons, and how to like stab people in the heart and behead them. And so can you talk a little bit about learning how to look as authentic as possible in these really brutal scenes that also had to be very carefully choreographed?
Yeah, the sequences, the way Robert Eggers, the filmmaker, the director of the movie, his style of working is quite unique, and especially when it comes to big action adventure films. Rob and Jaron Blaschke, his cinematographer, they shoot on film, which is quite rare these days, and all the scenes, almost all the scenes, definitely all the big set pieces, the big action scenes are shot in just one long continuous take, which complicates things quite a bit. Most films, you'll have several cameras going simultaneously and you have coverage, so you can cut into a big fight scene and just focus on one stunt. But Rob wanted the intimacy, the connection with the characters, and didn't want to feel any cuts, that you're actually hopefully a bit more immersed in the story and with the characters if you stay close, and that the audience feels that they're with Amleth throughout the whole fight. It complicated things in a way because, for example, there's the scene that follows the The little clip of us howling that we just heard in the beginning is a 3-minute long raid of a village. And with 20, 30 actors, 20, 30 stuntmen, hundreds of extras, there's horses, there's chickens flying through the frame. Again, a lot of moving components to making that work. And the camera's also moving with us throughout the scene. So it was technically quite challenging to accomplish that, but we knew that it would be. And so we started several months before we shot that scene and meticulously planning it and the choreography of it and the dance, so to speak, between us and the camera operator, because it had to be timed perfectly since we're moving, all of us are moving through this melee, this chaos. And it was quite an intense day when we shot that. So technically difficult, but I would say the flip side of that is it was so incredibly immersive for me as an actor, because again, Rob is all about historical accuracy and authenticity. So the village was built, you could move around at 360 and there weren't sets. It was built the way a village would have been built 1,000 years ago. So my job was almost halfway done when I came to set, because just stepping into those shoes and onto that set was such an immersive experience. And then the fact that you got to shoot it and move, once you're in that adrenaline filled state of mind and you're charging through the scene, sometimes it's quite exhausting to stop and go, which you normally do in a movie. You shoot something for a couple of minutes or a couple of seconds, and then you take a break, and then you go back and go at it again and again and again. So it's more of a roller coaster in terms of your level of adrenaline. This was, you kind of open the tap and then you get to, you're in it, you're absorbed in it, and you get to do it till the very end. Then you obviously have to go do it over and over again, because it was, again, technically very difficult to get all those components to work. But it was a really exhilarating and thrilling way of working that I'd never worked that way before. I learned a lot. It was challenging, but an extraordinary experience.
Since there were animals like chickens in the scene, if the chickens didn't get their part right, did you end up being angry at chickens because you had to do the scene over? Because
the chickens messed up? They were complete divas and wouldn't come out of their trailers, and they were very difficult to work with. But sometimes that would happen. Sometimes it would be something would happen 3 seconds before the end of the shot, and it could be something, just a horse facing the wrong way in the background, or a small detail that wasn't perfect. And then those takes were, they were tough when everything fell. You found that fluidity to it, and all the stunts worked, and the movement, and everything, and you were in it, and it felt great. And then you can't use that take because, again, a small detail. But it was, we just had to be patient and focused, and go back and do it again and again until the chickens did what we wanted them to do. And by the way, they are brilliant in the film.
Yes. Let's talk about your role in the last season of Succession, the one that ended, I guess, a few months ago. You play a tech billionaire in this who runs a streaming platform called Gojo. And, of course, the story centers around the Roy family, which owns a media empire. And they have, like, a lot of content, but they have a really bad streaming platform. So they want to buy you out so that they have a great streaming platform for their content. And, Logan Roy, who is the patriarch, is very old. He's been sick. No one knows how much longer he's going to live. The children, of course, the adult children, have been fighting to see who will succeed their father and head this company. So this is a scene at a party, and you and Kieran Culkin's character, Roman Roy, are talking in this party, and he's trying to convince you that you should have a meeting with his father and talk about selling out. So I should mention that previous to this meeting between your character and Kieran Culkin at the party, Logan Roy, the patriarch, I think he had wanted to meet with you, but instead you sent a representative, which really made Logan Roy, the patriarch, angry. And that's referred to when Kieran Culkin picks up the dialogue in this scene.
Question. My old man got a little bit grumpy this morning, but you weren't trying to humiliate him, right? I mean, everyone says, last big legacy content library, last super app streaming platform. We fit, obviously, right?
People say we fit.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I do have one question then.
Yeah, hit me up.
When will your father die?
When will my father die?
Yeah. Like, I don't want to be rude, but what kind of shape is he in? We're talking less than a year, or is more like 5 years? Because if it's five, that's a long time. Uh-huh. It would be better sooner, wouldn't it?
No, I know. Like, we're laughing here, but, you know, that is my dad, so, you know.
Right.
Yeah. Well, he's there, no, chief.
I can tell that it's a bit weird for me.
That's okay.
It's just, I don't like the idea of a man hanging over me.
No, I can understand. What's that?
Because it's not my world. Media.
Yeah.
So, his death would clear space.
Mm-hmm.
That scene is really funny, especially, like, the way you ask, like, when do you think your father will die?
It just cuts straight to the chase, yeah?
Yeah. My understanding is that you went right from doing Succession to doing The Northman. So you go from playing this, like, you know, wealthy, entitled tech billionaire to playing, like, this brutal Viking 1,000 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's such a contrast. Even, like, your posture, like, it, you know, in a scene in Succession, at, like, your home where the patriarch is there talking with you, like, you are, like, slouching in your couch with, like, your leg up. And it's not like a very respectful posture for meeting somebody who is your equal or more powerful than you.
No, and that's also, there were so many things that made that character so much fun to play, but one of them was that he didn't have to treat Brian Cox's character like a king. He's like, well, I don't care who Logan is. I don't need him in my life. And that is something unusual in the world that the Roys operate in, because he is the emperor to everyone else, and suddenly there's a guy who again is just like, doesn't even bother putting on shoes before the meeting. He's walking around in his flip flops and slouching on the couch, and then you know, suddenly decides, well, maybe I should buy you instead. And Brian Cox is obviously one of the greatest actors of our time, so to be able to work with him, and Karen is also phenomenal on such a beautifully written, fantastic and fun scene was a real treat. And we'd shot the majority of The Northman before that in Northern Ireland, but then we were going to go to Iceland and shoot a week or two out there right after shooting at that villa, the Lake Como house, which is, for anyone who's seen the episode, it's like the most beautiful house I've ever seen. It's absolutely stunning. And these Riva boats, these beautiful Italian wooden boats. And it's just like, it's there's so much wealth and luxury around that, like, it's mind boggling. And then I went straight from there to Iceland, where I was going to play a Viking slave. So I put on shackles and then I was being dragged through the mud, through the Icelandic mud. So that was an interesting 48 hours, to say the least.
Were you hooked on Succession before you had a role in it?
Yeah. So I've only said yes to something once before without reading the script. It was when Lars von Trier called and asked if I wanted to be in Melancholia. And I just said, I don't care what you want me to do, but I'll be there.
That's a great film. I really like that film.
Thank you, Terry. I had an amazing time shooting that. So it was, I do not regret saying yes without having read the script. And this would have been the second time. I absolutely adore Jesse Armstrong and admire everything he's done even before Succession, the Peep Show and the stuff he did in the UK. The writing is so smart. And I found season one and two of Succession some of the greatest television I'd ever seen. So when he reached out, I said, you don't even have to, like, eventually I'd love to know who you want me to play, but I'm in no matter what.
So you grew up in Stockholm. Your father is actor Stellan Skarsgård. And people probably know him from Good Will Hunting, more recently from Dune. He was in HBO's Chernobyl, Mamma Mia, The Avengers, Melancholia, Thor. So there's a lot of diverse films people may know him from. What were you exposed to about acting when you were a child? Like, how did acting look at you before you were seven, before you had an acting role yourself?
My dad did repertoire theater in Stockholm when I was a child. So he would rehearse during the day at the Royal Dramatic Theater in Stockholm. So he would rehearse during the day and then perform at night. And he worked with Ingmar Bergman on stage when I was a child.
He worked with Ingmar Bergman?
Yeah. Ingmar Bergman was just some old dude. So I wasn't really impressed by that when I was 5-6 years old. It was more fun to hang out back in the hair and makeup department of the theater and play around with prosthetics and wigs and stuff. So, and then my father's dear friend, Allan Edwall, who was a fantastic Swedish director and actor, needed a 7-year-old kid for a movie. And he was over at our house having dinner and saw a 7-year-old kid running around. So he asked if I had any interest in being in the movie. And so that's kind of how I got started.
So you became kind of famous in Sweden after you started in a TV series when you were 13. You've said that being a child actor in Sweden is different from being a child actor in Hollywood. What's the difference?
Well, first of all, the scale, it's basically like being famous in Idaho. No shade on Idaho, but it's obviously smaller than being famous internationally or in all states. It's it's a small country, Sweden, so it's a very small industry. And being famous wasn't, I never had a desire to become an actor, or it was never something I pursued. When I worked on Åkans Värld with the movie when I was 7 with Allan Edwall, that led to a couple of other jobs, and so for a couple of years I did work, or I guess 6 years until I was 13, on a couple of smaller Swedish productions, and then I did it wasn't a series, it was a made for TV movie, basically an hour long movie called Hunden som log, the smiling dog. And this is back when there were only two channels in Sweden, and obviously pre-internet. So whatever was on, people tended to watch. So it got, the impact of that quite changed my life quite a bit. It was suddenly recognized, and it made me uncomfortable. I think 13 is an awkward, uncomfortable age for most kids, but to then be in the spotlight and to be recognized and be different when you go to school, the fact that other people are giggling or whispering and are watching you in a different way made me very very uncomfortable, and I lost confidence and just was not comfortable with that. And so I decided to quit and not do any more projects. And again, it wasn't a monumental, difficult decision stepping away from it, and to have normal childhood wasn't a difficult decision for me.
I think it was during the period when you were not acting that you were in the Swedish military doing counterterrorism. Who were the suspected terrorists of the time?
It would have been, this was in the late 90s, around the millennium, basically. So the job of our unit was to secure the archipelago, the islands outside of Stockholm. And I went into it not for any heroic or patriotic reasons. I went into it because I'm from a very bohemian family of pacifists. I grew up in Södermalm, which is a very artistic neighborhood of South Stockholm, and surrounded by people that were not very physical, not very active, not very outdoorsy. It was mostly dinner parties with lots of wine flowing and conversations about art, rather than out in nature. So at the age of 19, I wanted to do it more as a personal challenge, it felt so kind of diametrically opposite my upbringing. So I wanted to to, I guess, challenge myself and go do something that was that I had never done before or experienced before.
How was the experience? How did it work out?
It was horrible and wonderful. It was a year and a half, and it was very challenging physically and mentally. But I think I learned a lot about myself and about working with others, because we worked in small units, myself and three other guys out in these islands. So we're very, we operated very independently. So I formed some strong friendships, and I'm in hindsight glad I did it. But
I want to hear about the horrible parts. what was horrible about it?
No, they test you, obviously, and it's when you go through on basic training, and then when you're out, and they want you to kind of find your limits and physically and mentally, and challenge you so that you can operate even under distress. So that was something that, as is quite a spoiled, comfortable kid from an urban area in Stockholm, where I never had to kind of deal with the elements. If it was raining, I just didn't go out, or if it's cold, I put on an extra jacket. So that was all kind of a, I wouldn't say shock, but definitely something I wasn't accustomed to.
It sounds like good training for the Northmen.
it was basically, it was pretty much the same. Northmen, we crawled around in mud for 7 months, and that's basically what I did for a year and a half in the military.
You were very self-conscious as a young actor at the age of 13, and you didn't want to act because you didn't like being different, you didn't like all the attention. When you got the role of Eric the Vampire in the HBO series True Blood a few years ago, you became a star from that. And not only that, you became a kind of heartthrob. So I'm wondering what that was like for you as somebody who had previously rejected the idea of being noticed as an actor, you know, offset.
Oh, suddenly I loved fame. I think I was old enough and a bit more confident and secure to be able to handle all the chaos around being an actor and being on a show that gets a lot of hits the zeitgeist and gets a lot of attention. I was able to still have a private life and I wouldn't say a public persona, but knowing when you're out in the world meeting people and instead of being, when someone recognized me or came up to me when I was younger, it made me uncomfortable. And instead I tried to kind of not lean into it, but at least embrace it. And genuinely being, when someone recognizes you and they like your character or a movie or a show you're on, and that is, why shouldn't that be a great feeling? Why shouldn't you feel grateful for that and be excited that what you've done, your work has actually reached someone and meant something to someone? So I try to approach it from that angle to take joy out of that. And the fact that, again, I'd been unemployed and struggling to find work for many years. Not only had I gotten a job, but I gotten a job that people actually cared about. And that is a wonderful feeling. That's definitely not always the case. And I think that mindset helped me when it got crazy around True Blood.
In Big Little Lies, you played Nicole Kidman's husband, and you were somebody who had to travel a lot. You felt like you were being shut out of the family, and this and other things would lead to fights with Nicole Kidman's character, and you'd get like really angry and end up like hitting her or shoving her against the wall or kind of strangling her, but not to death. And these scenes would typically end with you both having sex. And when I interviewed her recently, she said that in between these takes of like anger and physical force that would end up in sex, that she would lie on the floor in her underwear with a towel over her. And she couldn't get up. It wasn't like she physically couldn't get up. She emotionally couldn't get up. And the people around her, the crew, would ask, "Are you all right?" And she'd be crying and saying, "Yes, I'm fine," because she was trying to be professional. I'm wondering what impact those scenes had on you.
Yeah, they were some of the most difficult days I've experienced on a set. Nicole and I became very close on that experience really brought us together, and it demanded complete trust between us in order to go into that darkness physically and mentally. Those scenes were so horrific, and but we spent many days and weeks leading up to the shoot talking about the relationship, and we were both creatively excited because it felt like a nuanced, accurate depiction of an abusive relationship. Perry was not a cliche or stereotype of an abusive husband. And you could understand Celeste why she might have been drawn to him and why she might be conflicted in the beginning when he's oscillating between the light and the darkness. And that was something that we spent a lot of time talking about. And then going into those very, very intense scenes, they were horrific to shoot. And we had to check in with each other nonstop before takes, after takes, to make sure that, because we both had to commit so completely. But it was draining. It was draining. But walking away from it was, when we wrapped it up, I love Nicole so much, and it was absolutely wonderful to be reunited with her on The Northman, this time as my mother, but again, also a very dark, weird, twisted relationship. But I think because we had that, we'd established that trust on Big Little Lies, that was really valuable when we started shooting The Northman, having that strong connection. But no, those days, like the one you mentioned, they were horrible. They were horrible.
It's so odd that Nicole Kidman played your wife in Big Little Lies and your mother in the new film, The Northman.
Yeah, it was because after Big Little Lies, we basically said, let's find something to do again, but maybe something lighter. And then 2 years later, when I, when we had the first draft of The Northman, with Robert Eggers and all the producers, everyone agreed that Nicole would be the perfect Queen Gudrun. I called her and I said, "Well, I got something here. I don't know how much lighter it is. It's also quite dark." But we were just thrilled when she joined us. And after this, I promise the next project we do together will be a musical or a rom-com or something.
I think the closest you've been in a musical is maybe the Lady Gaga video of her song Paparazzi.
That's true. It's also quite dark. We try to kill each other in that one.
Yeah, you push her off a balcony.
I do.
You carry her onto the balcony, place her on the rail of it, give her a very passionate kiss, and then just kind of push her off.
Yeah.
And by the end of the song, by the end of the video, she's poisoned you. It's a music video. It's like a 7-minute music video, but it's packaged like it's a movie, you know, like Paparazzi starring Lady Gaga,
yeah,
and Alexander Skarsgård. And it's kind of written in letters like an old fashioned movie. Was that her attempt to like make a movie or, you know, fulfill her fantasy of starring in a film?
This is, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure it was her first album. I did not know who she was at the time. As a friend of mine, LA-based Swedish director named Jonas Åkerlund, directed that video. So, and I was shooting, True Blood wasn't even out yet. So I was shooting season one of True Blood. I'm pretty sure season one wasn't even out yet. And he called and asked he's going to do this music video with an artist named Lady Gaga. And he explained the premise of it, and it sounded super fun. It was going to be shot over a weekend in Malibu. And I said, "Yeah, Jonas, I'll come do this Lady Goo Goo video any day." I don't know who she is, but it sounds great.
Did it lead to anything that surprised you?
No, not more than we had a fantastic week and it was super fun. She was great to play with. And Jonas and I had to teach her some Swedish because we speak Swedish in the beginning of it. And she was wonderful, absolutely fantastic. But it was, again, two fun, great days. And I was like, "Well, the song is catchy. Best of luck to you, Lady Goo Goo." I had no idea how big she would get.
when you were growing up and your father, Stellan Skarsgård, was acting and had all these like bohemian friends and, artists and actors and so on, you've said that you wished he was more ordinary. What kind of father did you wish you had when you were going through that stage of wishing that, like, your father was like the other fathers?
Well, I remember my friend, a friend in my class, his dad wore a gray suit and drove a Saab and had a briefcase and worked in an office. And that was my dream dad. I was like, oh, my God. What if I had a dad like that? That would have been the dream. My buddy is so lucky because my dad would wear like some flowy dress or nothing and just walk around with a glass of red wine and the hair standing up and like just I just wanted to be normal and not different and not stand out. And so everything about my family was quite atypical. So everything about it that subsequently came to embrace and love about my family, or I was at an age where to the point of like leaving the film industry because I just wanted to blend in and be like everyone else. And having a dad like Stellan definitely didn't help.
You said he was wearing flowy dresses?
Yeah, he would wear like or some like Arabian garb, like some long something he found on a trip somewhere, or a sarong, which definitely wasn't a thing in Stockholm in the 80s. It just definitely not a gray suit like my friend's father.
Have you worked with your I know you work with your father in Melancholia. Have you worked with him in other films? What's that like for you?
No, we haven't. We worked together. So Melancholia, Dad plays my best man at my wedding. And we had one or two scenes together. And I loved every second of it. But that was it. So it wasn't really a meaty, rich, interesting relationship. It was, again, a couple of days. But I would love to do something. It's just about finding the right project. But yeah, no, that'd be a dream.
So thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you, Terry. This has been such a pleasure. And to end the whole 2-month-long press tour with a conversation with Terry Gross on Fresh Air, it is an honor.
Alexander Skarsgård stars in the new film, The Northman.